Abigail Farmer. I'm a psychiatrist. It says in the report you tried to drown yourself. Is that true? I hate this name they gave you, John Doe 83. Can you tell me your real name? Is that light bothering you?
Zeljko Ivanek. Zeljko Ivanek. I've just always loved the way that name rolls and bounces and just kind of drips off the tongue. It's just a perfect combination of obscure consonants and vowels that are just blended together. Greetings once again to Natsukashi, located at the corner of Movies and Memories. My name is Rob, and I have plucked out of true obscurity for this episode a 1982 supernatural thriller called The Sender, starring a young Zeljko Ivanek as John Doe 83, not to be confused with the former frontman of the punk rock band John Doe and the punk rock band X. Our introduction to this John Doe demonstrates that he either has suicidal tendencies, again in keeping with the punk rock theme, or he's certainly just had a really crappy swim coach, for he proceeds to load up his Letterman's jacket with rocks, and then he heads to the deep end of a public swimming area. It's a terrifying shot, actually, in a film that I felt as a child had several terrifying shots. And with me this evening, joining me on this return visit to The Sender, I have a regular contributor to the Natsukashi site, Count Fargelon. Count, how are you?
I'm great, Rob. And I gotta say, this isn't my pick, this is your pick, and I'm really glad you asked me to take part, because I'd never heard of this film, and I feel really lucky to have, you know, picked up on it.
I'm surprised at just how obscure it is. I can understand a film that bombs at the box office, but I'm surprised it really hasn't picked up much love throughout the years from the kind of horror, supernatural, sci-fi community, because it really is... It's got some real gem moments. I'm not saying overall it's a wonderful picture, but it's got some really interesting, fascinating moments to it.
Oh, it absolutely does. And let's not forget, it's not like it doesn't star anybody famous. Zeljko Ivanek has gone on to become, you know, the go-to guy for sleazy authority figures over the past 20 years.
He's cut quite a career path for himself, and it was just interesting to see this being his first screen role. Just what a fantastic job he did with such little dialogue.
Yeah, it's mostly a body language role in the film, because he plays right from that opening scene you talked about where he goes wandering into the water trying to drown himself. He's so fragile for the entire film. Like, everything about him, he gives off this victim vibe for the whole movie. He's always shuddering and reacting and, like, having sharp reactions to people, and his voice is so quivering and hesitant. Like, it's a great performance.
Yeah, it really is. In a film that I think has several of them. Let's get into a little about it. We also, I should note, have quotes throughout here. We contacted Sally Jones, who was the film's script supervisor. She couldn't join us for the podcast, but she has provided us with many behind-the-scenes tidbits for your listening pleasure. So throughout here, I will pepper this conversation with quotes from Ms. Jones.
You, he nearly killed the Messiah. He's totally without control.
Oh, then by all means, let's control
him. Dr. Farmer, I know how you feel about this patient.
What about his feelings? Or weren't you going to ask him?
No, I was going to leave that up to you.
The Sender was released in 1982, and Catherine Harold, who... in my mind's eye, it was Kelly McGillis. Kelly McGillis was the psychiatrist that I saw, that I remember seeing. And obviously it was not her. It was Catherine Harold. I could have sworn. And they look kind of interchangeable in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in your defense, there's an entire class of blonde 80s actresses who are completely interchangeable. So it was an easy mistake to make.
Thank you. Thank you for coming to my defense. And I didn't mean that their performances aren't noteworthy. They do all have an impressive body of work, but they were very similar in appearance.
Exactly.
The film also starred Paul Freeman, who many of us who grew up in the 80s remember as Belloc, one of the main bad guys from Raiders of the Lost Ark. And this film was released on October 22nd. It was up against First Blood, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, and Monsignor and the Bette Midler vehicle, Jinxed.
Wow.
All of them. Every single one of them, unfortunately, beat The Sender at the box office. It's pretty bad when Bette Midler's Jinx beats you at the box office. So and a resounding beating. So it opened at 300 screens, and it grossed not even a half mil on its opening weekend. It went on to gross about $1 million altogether. It marked the directorial debut of one Roger Christensen, who prior to this was a set decorator on Star Wars. He was an art director on Alien, and he was an art director in Monty Python's Life of Brian. So far, so good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, a mere 18 years later, he would go on to direct a film that won a total of 6 top honors. Those awards, of course, were the Razzies, and the film, of course, was Battlefield Earth, which swept the competition that year, not only for Worst Picture, but Worst Actor, Worst Director, Worst Screen Couple, Worst Screenplay, Worst Supporting Actor and Actress, but it had the dubious distinction of winning, quote-unquote, the worst drama of Razzie's first 25 years. No small feat, that.
I'm going to tell the briefest of stories about Battlefield Earth before we go on to Roger Christian's earlier, better work. And that is, because I knew somebody who worked at a comic book shop, I got a chance to see Battlefield Earth on an early screening, one of those advanced screenings for the press and fans and whoever phones into a radio show. I was in Ottawa at the time, and because the film was made in Montreal, there were actually some Ottawa actors in it. So in order to promote the film, they had a bunch of the actors come to the movie, and there was applause and cheering and announcing the film and talking about it a little beforehand. So we started watching the movie, and if you've seen the movie, you know it's wall-to-wall unintentional laughter. But about 45 minutes into the movie, a fire alarm went off in the theater, and they announced that it was a false alarm, but everyone was going to have to move out into the lobby, but they would start the movie once they cleared everything out in 10 minutes. And that was a 500-person theater that was packed to the gills. When my friend and I went back in after the fire alarm, there were only 80 people left.
Was John Travolta anywhere near that alarm bell?
I've always suspected that he set it off personally because everybody fled the theater. The radio show hosts fled the theater. No one wanted to be there for the continuing audience reaction to this god-awful movie.
Everyone in the theater was like, thank you, divine intervention.
Well, how do you leave a movie theater when one of the guys who's in it is sitting right there?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a fire alarm.
That's
perfect.
Perfect, perfect.
He's lost without me. He's never been away from home. I'm all he's ever known. I'm a good mother. I raised a powerful, good son.
Yes, I know. Will you tell me his name?
You're in dangerous water. Take it from me.
I appreciate the warning.
If you don't mind, I'd like someone else to hear this.
The sender was shot predominantly in the UK in a town called Elstree, where the neighbors were constantly calling police station. This is according to Sally Jones, complaining about the explosions. Now, this is not an explosion-filled film, but there are a couple incendiary scenes. But since they were all shot at night, their slumber was disturbed, and they made repeated calls to the police, which interrupted the production of the film. And it's kind of like an anti-Nightmare on Elm Street, really, in that a lot of it existed in this sort of dream state. Zeljko plays this young boy who is, we never know his name, but he has the ability to share his dreams and nightmares, well, mostly his nightmares, with others, and apparently that kind of individual is called a sender. as many troubled young lads in films of this nature, he also had mommy issues as well, and she makes several appearances in the film, and it's not quite sure whether she's an apparition or if she's this figment of his imagination, where she's a ghost, whether she's a real person. But she has the boy convinced that he was born of Immaculate Conception. And the film does toy with some religious concepts, but never really takes them anywhere. It just kind of leaves them hanging. And that could really sum up a lot of this film, is that there were a lot of interesting issues that were brought up, never fully realized, but interesting nonetheless, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. There's a few really key scenes in the movie. Like, for example, take what you just said about his mother. There are so many possibilities for what his mother is. Like, from the first time she appears, you know she's not real. There's no chance of that. But, sorry, is it one of his dreams that he's externalizing right. The way he has the ability right. to? Or, considering the fact that they make it abundantly clear that he has always been in constant mental contact
and
with his mother.
Physical.
They open up this kind of weird possibility. Yeah. They open up this weird possibility that upon her death, her entire consciousness wound up inside him, and now he's stuck with her forever.
On that note, Sally had made mention of this. She said there were a lot of, quote, story issues that had us all in a bit of a quandary at times. For example, should there be a dent in the pillow where the ghost of the mother had lain? And she said it was amazing how many times the question arose, what evidence in this, quote-unquote, reality does a ghost leave behind? And what is acceptable and believable to the audience? You know, apparently she was some sort of apparition, but it's still not quite sure, you know, in what kind of context that she was seen in and believed to be by the characters.
I want to point out that how much I love that behind the scenes, these kinds of discussions were going
yeah.
on. For that movie, because I see so many movies where I can't imagine anyone giving serious thought to
yeah.
almost anything. Like, I just watched The Unborn, and
sorry about
it's
that.
Like no one thought for a second about the plot. I know. Thought for a second about the plot, whereas here you have The Sender, a relatively small movie, and you have people debating behind the scenes, you know, what is physically real and what isn't, like how much effect do his dreams have? That's such a great idea.
And it's a film, I think, that has a lot of great ideas. It looks like there was a lot of thought given to the proceedings. Now, whether they followed them to their conclusion is up for debate, but you could tell even with the character development, too. I mean, I felt like, as you said earlier, with Zelchko's performance, it was mainly a physical one. And here we have a character who... It's strange that the person who is capable of inhabiting his nightmares in other people's heads is still a sympathetic character.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, and like you say, he's the anti-Freddy Krueger because he's not doing it intentionally to hurt everyone. I mean, it's just that he's been so damaged by his upbringing that in many other films, that would be the origin of a serial killer, whereas here... He's just literally letting you see what it's like being inside of his head all the time.
What's in for?
My memory.
Memory? Look, don't worry about the Messiah. Lost his marbles in India. Thinks he's the chosen one. Listen. Stick with me, kid. I'm faking it. They want to send me back to Vietnam. Shit, man, I'm saying it in all of them.
So tell me something. How are our boys doing out there?
Where?
Man.
They're finished. Years ago, the war's over.
Oh, shit. Not you too, kid, huh? They told you to say that! Well, I'm not going back there! F*** it! I'm not going back! Yeah!
I was impressed by the characters in the mental ward, which, obviously, in films of this nature, are typically... You could copy and paste them in 1,000 different films where they show mental ward patients. But these guys had at least some sort of distinct identity and almost a development, a character development to each and every one of them.
I mean, I don't know if it was clearly meant literally this way, but they seem to reflect different aspects of his personality, because you've got one who thinks he's Jesus and one who's going through post-traumatic stress disorder. He seems to, in his neuroses, encompass the problems of all the other patients in the hospital.
Exactly. Of all the performances, I was especially impressed this second time around by Catherine Harold, who played Dr. Gail Farmer, because here is somebody who she seemed honestly concerned for her patients, but she wasn't a pushover. I mean, there was a delicate balance there, because you can usually have one extreme or the other. You can either have, like, the nurse ratchet kind, or you can have the, you know, the flighty, hippy-dippy one who just wants to love everybody and see, make sure that they're free and so on and so forth. But she struck this really interesting balance of kind of almost tough love, not a pushover, but was a very solid, interesting character.
And I've got to say, completely rational in her reactions to the supernatural things happening around her.
Yeah, and speaking of which, Sally made note of that. There was one instance where Dr. Gail Farmer walks into her bedroom, and again, this is another dream sequence or nightmare sequence where there's a body lying on the floor with rats all around, and she said that she said Catherine Harold had a hard time with that sequence, which you can't imagine that, a room full of rats. But she said when it came time to shoot, you wouldn't even be able to tell it. She said she was an utter professional. Like, the second they yelled action, she said she just hopped right to it and went right through as if it was just regular carpeting. So, and there were a lot of rats. There were a lot of rats.
I was going to ask about that scene, because when I was watching that scene, I was wincing, because you get a lot of close-ups of that floor, and what it makes clear is that when you have 1,000 rats on a floor, that means the floor is not just carpeted with rats, but rat droppings, which are clearly visible all over that, like, white or light gray carpeting. Like, how is she walking across this?
That also brings up another interesting scene in there where she opens up a refrigerator, and again, this is another dream projection, but she opens up a refrigerator to get a bottle of medicine, and it's filled with cockroaches. Now, she said Sally recalled in filming that scene in particular, and she says, I quote, "We all had an unnerving experience with the cockroaches. The camera crew, myself, and director all squeezed in an alcove behind a tall freezer loaded with cockroaches.
What were you looking for?
The Thorazine.
Where's the Thorazine? It's right in front of your nose.
The camera pointing down over the corridor, over top of the fridge, to see Dr. Farmer walking down the corridor toward the fridge slash camera. Hundreds of the beasties, as she called them, were crawling out of the little crevices in the back, hissing and flying around our faces, up the cameraman's ankles and under his trouser legs. Nobody dare make a sound. We were all wedged back against the wall with no place to escape. The animal handlers said they collected all the cockroaches. When the nightmare was finally over and Roger yelled cut, the animal handlers promised us they gathered up all the escaped 100 cockroaches. Hope they didn't speak with forked tongues or the studio hides a big secret. But oh, just imagine filming that shot, and you have to be absolutely and utterly silent. You have all these live cockroaches that are just coming out of the back and just jumping all over you, crawling up your leg. You're not allowed to move. You have to stay in perfectly still, like a combat soldier in the jungle. I couldn't even imagine that.
Well, I think what amazes me most about this movie is that it's a movie that hasn't found an audience at all. It doesn't have a cult. It doesn't have a reputation. I had never heard about it before you mentioned it to me at all. And I think one of the reasons for that is it's a horror movie without a body count at all.
Yeah, it's a cerebral horror.
It's entirely psychological. Exactly. That's what I was getting at. The stakes are all within characters' minds.
But the thing that I'm surprised that it hasn't caught on is that there are some really spectacular quote-unquote death scenes in this movie. I mean, when you talk about the rat sequence, when there's a rat coming out of one of the characters' mouths, There's a
no, and a slashed throat.
A slashed throat, a head that actually gets you know, palm. This guy hits with an open palm and knocks this guy's head clear off.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some pretty graphic scenes in there, and yet they haven't received love throughout the years, which I think is kind of disheartening, because I guess this is a perfect segue into the most recent viewing of it. Now, after sitting down and seeing this again, I totally stand by my initial take on this film's creepiness factor, as I wrote about in the preamble to this. For all the unanswered questions that it leaves, and for all the frayed ends to the ropes of the story, there's a lot that this film does right. From the minimal effective score of Trevor Jones did the score, to the cinematography, which Roger Pratt did the cinematography. He's done work on a couple Harry Potter films, 12 Monkeys, and he has this. There's this overall kind of almost like the original Halloween with John Carpenter. It's got that kind of bloodless autumn look to it.
Oh, absolutely. And honestly, the fact that it was all, you know, 1982 and set in a hospital got me thinking about Halloween too. Those long, cold hallways.
Yeah, exactly. And the sterility of it was effective, you know, against the madness. To have it set in this, you know, sterile environment was quite a nice contrast.
I gotta say, you want to talk about that sterile environment going bad, there's that electroshock sequence that was really intense.
Dr. Farmer, Catherine Herod's character, argues against electroshock therapy for this young John Doe, and they proceed with it anyway against her wishes. During that sequence, he projects one of his nightmares into the minds of all who are involved in this electroshock treatment, the nurses, the doctors, so on and so forth, sending them all hurling into walls, into carts, against glass windows. You know, I'm not ruining anything by saying it is a dream sequence, but it's shot rather effectively, aside from a couple corny-looking jump backs from some of the actors. It's still effective even with a glass that kind of fixes itself when it's shot in reverse. That was still very, very creepy, especially in slow motion.
Oh, it absolutely was. And I gotta say, the thing about this movie that really got me was I had just done my AVOD complaining about movies where most of the film is a dream and how much of a cheat that is. But here, you know, just like Nightmare on Elm Street, it's so far from a cheat, because it's a film that actually is analyzing, you know, uses dreams for something other than a way to have a scary thing happen without derailing the plot, which is, you know, the most of what dreams are used for in horror movies. Like, we need a scare here, but we don't want to screw up the plot. Whereas here, they're actually looking into what dreams are and the nightmare scenario of what if you could live someone else's nightmare.
Precisely. And not only that, but it also looks at almost examines the mind of a mental patient, of just how they possibly see things, how they project, how they, you know, if someone is overwhelmed with psychosis, sometimes these violent fantasies that would play out in their head, we get to see them firsthand. And I think it's really, really effective.
Yeah, I mean, this is a movie that I'm going to be recommending to people. This is a movie that I'm sure going to be talking about. And I don't want to put too fine a point on this, but I'm surprised that, you know, no one seems to know about this movie, that this is the first I have ever heard about this film.
Let's throw that gauntlet down, and we'll start the Sender fan club right here and now on this episode of Natsukashi. You know, I will say that for its faults, which it does have, you know, this is not a perfect movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it gets more right.
Oh, God, no.
It gets more right than it gets wrong. And I will say that, you know, as a 12-year-old, when I first saw this on HBO, when it finally appeared, and being sufficiently creeped out by it, then I think I had good taste as a preteen enjoying this movie, and I would definitely say that it's something that I would wholeheartedly sit through again.
Don't come near me.
He's been guillotined. Says he can't move his head. It'll fall off. How come it didn't fall off?
He's biding his time.
Who?
John Doe.
Did he threaten to cut your head off?
Yes.
You lie like a dog. He never said boo to you, Private!
I don't know what it was about 1982, but that was one hell of a year for genre movies. Because wasn't that also Blade Runner and The Thing that year?
Oh, yeah. I mean, 1982 was a creative explosion on all fronts there, so...
I mean, and yeah, The Sender isn't up there with The Thing or Blade Runner, but I gotta say, it deserves to be mentioned when people talk about 82 and the genre explosion, because, you know, it's a film that takes, and I guess this is my favorite kind of genre film, it takes place in our real world, and then one unusual thing is added to our real world, one fantastical thing, and then everyone's reactions to it are completely believable, and the plot expands based on rational people trying to deal with a single irrational thing. I love that concept. I love that frame of a story, and this is a perfect example of that type of story.
He didn't have a head. I swear to God, he had no head.
It's all right, it's not your fault.
I'll take care of it. You take John Doe back to his ward, okay?
So then, Count, any final statements on The Sender for you?
Okay, well, I do have one final comment to go with that. I agree with everything you said, and also I want to say that one of my favorite things to see in movies is to see cabins that are next to lakes explode because they were filled with gasoline and dynamite. And this movie had one hell of an exploding dynamite cabin gasoline thing, because there's an explosion at the end of this movie that pissed off the people of that town, and they had a right to be pissed off.
In fact, probably like three or four towns over, they probably had a right. Count, I appreciate you calling in from Castle Vargelon for this special episode, and thank you also to Sally Jones, the script supervisor, for providing us with that information. I'm tickled that we were able to at least get a few peeks behind the curtain of how this was made. Thank you very much, Count. I appreciate it, and we will look forward to your next contribution as well, and you have a good evening there at the castle. Take care.
Always a pleasure, Rob. Thanks for inviting me.
Bye.
Bye-bye.